Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
948 days, 12 hours, 54 minutes, 1 second, until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily, unless he's impeached before then. Welcome, my friends, Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live, coast-to-coast, border-to-border, streaming around the planet here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up on today's program, Cal Dooley, the president of the Grocery Manufacturers Association, is going to drop by and tell us why he wants big government conservatives to take away the power of the states to control their own food supplies. Yep, that's what he's going to tell us. That'll be in the next hour of the program. Should be very entertaining. Congressman Bernie Sanders is typically with us on the first hour of our Friday program. Today, Bernie's unable to be with us. So, going to be me here, as usual, about the other 14 hours a week. And if you want to give us a shout on pretty much any topic that's on your mind, we will get to those also today. Our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States, 866-440-8466 is our toll-free telephone number. A new face at the top of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. As we briefly touched on yesterday, and I've been saying this for some time, George W. Bush, in order to be Superman himself, in order to be the tough guy, in order to be the superhero, in order to be the Schwarzenegger action figure that he wants Americans to perceive him as, and he certainly wants GIs to think of him as, in order to be that, he has to have an enemy. He has to have what Roosevelt had in Hitler, except Hitler was a real guy, and he really was trying to take over the world. And so, and Bush, for a while there, I guess you could argue that he sort of had that in bin Laden. You know, he had a real anti-hero, a real genuine anti-hero. And then, of course, he was a little less than successful at finding him.
So I don't know where he is. I just don't spend that much time on him, really, to be honest with you. Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
Yeah, well, that didn't work out all that well. So, and it certainly didn't play well in Iraq. So they had to come up with another bad guy, because they couldn't get out. They couldn't get bin Laden. As I've been saying for 2 years now, I am convinced he's dead. But in any case, George W. Bush has been unable to get bin Laden. And Afghanistan is devolving into chaos. It has become the world's largest narco state. It's just an absolute disaster. And Bush has decided to move all of our resources, divert all of our resources over to Iraq. And to be in Iraq, Bush had to figure out a way. And not just Bush. I mean, the neocons, the whole bunch in this administration, they had to figure out a way to cause Americans, and particularly GIs, to believe that there's some connection between Iraq and 9/11, because it takes a galvanizing event. As the Project for a New American Century pointed out back in 1998, and, the document that was signed by Jeb Bush, this was back when they were figuring that Jeb was going to be the next Bush to be president, the dynasty. Signed by Jeb Bush and Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Doug Feith and, company. They said that we should attack Iraq immediately. They called on Clinton to do it in 98. And B, that probably the American people wouldn't support this unless there was a Pearl Harbor-type event. Yes, that was the phrase they used. So Bush got his Pearl Harbor-type event on 9/11 due to the incompetence of his own administration. The absolute mind-numbing incompetence of Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney. I talked with Sandy Berger about 2 years ago, and he said that when I handed off, he was the National Security Advisor under Bill Clinton, right? He had what was Condi Rice's job during the first four years or so of the Bush administration. And he said when I was handing off my job to Condi Rice, and I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but pretty close. He said I told her the number one priority that you're going to have is Osama bin Laden, because he has hit us a couple of times. USS Cole, involved apparently in the World Trade Center bombing. We have tried to kill him a couple of times. We missed him just by a little bit. The Republicans with their whole, every time we went after him, the Republicans would start yelling and screaming, "Oh, Bill's trying to wag the dog. He's trying to, get us to forget about Monica." And, we were not successful in getting him. We stopped several terrorist attacks. We stopped a lot of the stuff that he was doing, but we didn't get bin Laden. And he's out there, and he's going to try and get us. That has to be your first priority. And Condi Rice got all these very specific warnings that bin Laden had hijackers in the United States, that there were people in the United States, that they were looking at hijacking airplanes, that they were looking at high-profile buildings. I mean, all of this stuff now is a matter of public record. And did what? Well, on August 6th of 2001, we know that she gave a presidential daily briefing to George W. Bush that said bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. And what did Bush do? Ah! Longest vacation in the history of the American presidency. He fled. And of course, when 9/11 happened, he froze for 7 minutes, and then he hopped on his plane and ran around the country like a chicken with its head cut off, running from city to city. Terrified. So he had to invent a bad guy in Iraq so that he could have somebody in Iraq that he could somehow cause to, in the minds of Americans, he could somehow conflate with 9/11. He could cause people to think, when they think 9/11, they think Iraq. This is the fundamental problem that he had. How do you get Americans to think Iraq, to think 9/11 when they think of Iraq? And, of course, there's the simple, straightforward way that Bush did it over and over and over again. Whenever you give a speech about Iraq, you include reference to 9/11, which he did very consistently for 3 years. But even better, if you could find somebody from Al-Qaeda in Iraq and put that person in Iraq and fail to take them out. David, do you have that story from Jim Mikhlishevsky from NBC News from 2 years ago?
I don't.
You don't? Okay. We were using it yesterday. If you can get, Zarqawi, here's this guy. He was up under the no-fly zone. He was under the protection. You do. Thank you. Under the protection of the United States. I mean, this is NBC News. This was reported in March 2nd, 2004. NBC News has learned that long before the war, the Bush administration, keep in mind, this is before we invaded Iraq. The Bush administration had several chances to wipe out Zarqawi's terrorist operation and perhaps kill Zarqawi himself, but they never pulled the trigger. Why? Because Bush needs a boogeyman. He needed a boogeyman in Iraq. This is before the invasion in order to justify the invasion. If Bush had successfully taken out Zarqawi before the invasion, he would not have been able to say there is somebody in Iraq who has links to Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda somehow has links to 9/11. And therefore, you could say that there's a connection between Iraq and 9/11. Now, the problem that Zarqawi had was that Saddam Hussein wanted to kill him. He was up there in the north hiding under our protection so that Saddam Hussein couldn't get at him because Hussein hated the Al-Qaeda. He saw Al-Qaeda as a threat to his power base. He did not want radical Islamic elements operating in his country. He was running a secular country. So here's this report from Jim Mikhlishevsky. In June 2002, keep in mind, this is three months before 9/11, U.S. officials say intelligence had revealed, I'm reading from an NBC News report by Jim Mikhlishevsky, the Pentagon correspondent for NBC News. U.S. officials say intelligence had revealed that Zarqawi and members of Al-Qaeda had set up a weapons lab at Kirma in northern Iraq, producing deadly ricin and cyanide. The Pentagon quickly drafted plans to attack the camp with cruise missiles and airstrikes and sent that plan to the White House. Right. Where, according to U.S. government sources, the plan was debated to death in the National Security Council. That's Condi Rice. We had targets. We had opportunities. We had a country willing to support casualties or risk casualties after 9/11, and we still didn't do it, said Michael O'Hanlon, military analyst at the Brookings Institution. 4 months later, intelligence showed Zarqawi. Now, this is still before we have attacked Iraq. 4 months later, intelligence showed Zarqawi was planning to use ricin and terrorist attacks in Europe. The Pentagon drew up a second strike plan, and the White House again killed it. Again, I'm quoting from NBC News here. By then, the administration has set its course for war in Iraq. As National Security Council former member Roger Cressy said, quote, people were more obsessed with developing a coalition to overthrow Saddam than to execute the president's policy of preemption against terrorists. In other words, they wanted to have a war. They didn't want to get Zarqawi. They wanted to have a war. In January 2003, the threat turned real. Police in London, again, quoting Jim Mikuláševsky here, police in London arrested six terror suspects and discovered a ricin lab connected to the camp in Iraq. The Pentagon drew up still another attack plan, and for the third time, the National Security Council killed it. Why? Military officials insist their case for attacking Zarqawi's operation was airtight, but, again, quoting Jim Mikuláševsky, NBC News, a year ago, the administration feared destroying the terrorist camp in Iraq would undercut its case for war against Saddam. Well, so now Saddam is gone, and Zarqawi is gone, so now they've got to come up with a new guy, al-Masri. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm an independent trucker. I'm put 11 overloaded on her operator, just tearing up the kitty main road. Yeah.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. By the way, we have a comment line if you'd like to call. If you don't want to go on the air, but you would like your thoughts to be heard and possibly heard by everybody, just pick up the phone and call 503-323-6620. 503-323-6620. Give us your take in 30 seconds or less because we want to hear from you. 503-323-6620. Remember, your thoughts and opinions may just make it on the air, so make it count. 503-323-6620. Another public service from the Tom Hartman Radio Program. This breaking news from Judicial Watch. Judicial Watch is the, I don't know how to describe it beyond right wing. It's a very conservative organization. Larry Klayman started the thing. He's gone on now to run for political office. I believe he's still associated with them. They're the guys who did the lawsuits, the initial lawsuits in the Paula Jones case that led to the uncovering of Bill Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky. And they also then sued the vice president, sued Dick Cheney, over his energy task force. This was the case where they actually got the papers, the documents, showing that in March and April of 2001, before 9/11, Dick Cheney's office was meeting with these folks from the oil industry and figuring out how to divide up. They were literally dividing up the property of Iraq by oil field and looking at which countries and which places they're going to sell it to. Well, now Judicial Watch has gone back and they must have a burr under their saddle about Cheney and Halliburton, because this is the newest one. This is their news release just out minutes ago. Judicial Watch announced today that the Department of the Army, per order of U.S. District Judge Ricardo M. Urbina, has released to Judicial Watch approximately 100 pages of documents which detail the multi-billion-dollar no-bid contract awarded in 2003 by the Army to Kellogg Brown and Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton. Now, one has to ask, why does it take a lawsuit to get this out? I mean, shouldn't government documents be transparent? No, apparently not. Anyhow, they say what these... One document uncovered by Judicial Watch suggests the United States Army Corps of Engineers may have publicly lied regarding the involvement of the vice president's office in awarding the contract. Whoa, Dick Cheney, the former CEO of Halliburton, is helping to make sure that Halliburton gets some money from we the people? You tell me this doesn't stink? In an email dated April 22, 2003, Carol Sanders of the Corps of Engineers writes, quote, Mr. Robert Anderson, chief counsel, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, participated in a 60 Minutes interview today in New York regarding the sole source award of the oil response contracts to Kellogg Brown and Root. Mr. Anderson was able to make many of the points we had planned. Get this. Sanders subsequently provided sound bites for the interview, including, quote, there was no contact whatsoever with the VP office, with the vice president's office, end quote. This, says Judicial Watch in their news release, directly contradicts another email uncovered by Judicial Watch in 2004. That email, dated March 5, 2003, sent by an official at the Army Corps of Engineers, whose name is redacted, said, quote, we anticipate no issue with the KBR deal since the action has been coordinated with the VP's office, end quote. They go on to say the newly released documents also prove the Department of the Army abused the Freedom of Information Act process by improperly invoking exemptions. One document, for example, includes a frank admission by an Army Corps of Engineer official saying, quote, I'm copying you on this crap since I honestly believe the competitive procurement will never happen, end quote. The Army attempted to withhold this embarrassing document even though no appropriate exemption applied. It took the intervention of a federal district judge to force the Army to release the information. Judicial Watch says, noting Vice President Cheney's prior relationship to Halliburton, Judicial Watch filed its FOIA request to obtain documents pertaining to the lucrative no-bid contract. The vice president's associations with Halliburton, quote, raised concerns about the appearance of a conflict of interest or favoritism, particularly since the contract was awarded to KBR without a bidding process and because the contract was not announced to the public until after it was approved. It is just incredible. Just incredible. And so it might be, you know, Judicial Watch might be bringing down another president. I mean, who knows? We'll see. We'll see how this thing shakes out. But if so, pretty amazing stuff. Pretty amazing stuff. And by the way, speaking of, we started out talking about how Bush has to have a new Zarqawi. His old Zarqawi is dead. All right, so he's got to have a new Zarqawi. So they're saying it's this guy Al Masri, also known as the Egyptian. And although, you know, there's some doubt about, well, as Al Siri said, I'm 95% sure this Al-Masri doesn't exist. He says Al-Qaeda does not want to show that he is an Iraqi because they work under the Islamic bat or they seek international jihad. Well, we'll see. That's it. But I guarantee you that we know now that the Pentagon ran a disinformation campaign to inflate the importance and significance, to, you know, just blow it all out of proportion of Zarqawi. They're now going to do the same thing with Al-Masri. Because Bush wants people to think that we are fighting against Al-Qaeda in Iraq, when in fact, yes, there may be Al-Qaeda. Yes, there is. There are some folks from Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Of course. I mean, we're there, right? But the vast majority of the attacks against the United States and against Americans are coming from Iraqis themselves as a result of this failed occupation, not war. 27 minutes past there. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
There you go. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, it is getting tough. And increasingly, economists are starting to worry about the pass-through effect of the rise in the price of gasoline. You recall that for years and years and years, conservatives argued that there should not be an increase in the gasoline tax in the United States. The gasoline tax is fixed as I recall, 14 cents a gallon federally nationwide. And it was argued back during the Carter administration, back in the 70s, that it should become a percentage because if prices go up, then the tax would go up as well. And, you know, as a percentage, it would always track inflation because as inflation continues, that 14 cents a gallon becomes worth less and less. In fact, now it costs more than a penny to make a penny, right? So, but the conservatives always said, no, don't do that, because if you do that, if you drive up the price of gasoline, you will create inflation and recession. Well, the price of gasoline has doubled in the last 2 years. And on the one hand, you got the Bushies running around going, ah, there's no inflation, there's no recession. On the other hand, you got a lot of economists going, this could be a problem. And see, we're talking about doubled. I mean, what people were suggesting before was, eh, why don't you raise the gas tax another 10 cents? No, this is $2. The average American family right now is contributing $1,300 to the profits, not the operating expenses, to the profits of the oil industry. In other words, the people who make their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive from ExxonMobil or Chevron or Shell or BP, those people are receiving $1,200, $1,300, $1,400, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, per year from the average American family in dividend checks. Well, some of it the oil companies are hanging on to, but in profits, incredible. 1-866-440-8466, our number, Monica in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Monica, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Tom, I just watched this House debate that went on yesterday and then for a little while this morning before they voted. It just keeps crossing my mind. Ever since 2003, the Republican mantra, you know, has been, you don't support the troops, you don't support the troops. And whenever anybody said anything about the troops, the Democrats, they always prefaced everything with, I support the troops. They need to point out that the Republicans hide behind the troops to avoid any facts coming out of Iraq, and that they use them as human political shields to keep this war going.
Yeah, well said.
You know,
well said.
It's just sad. They did it with Zarqawi last week. Somebody must have said, Democrats are sad that Zarqawi's dead. And in every interview any Democrat did was, oh, Zarqawi's death is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know?
They were hyperventilating about it more than the Republicans were.
It's because they had to come out, well, we think it's a great thing and we support our troops. And they need to quit playing that kind of stuff, Tom. They really, really do. I mean, it's just rhetoric, and I think that they need to point out that that's what the Republicans do. They've hid behind the troops. They use them, you know, and I just think it's really, really sad. The debate should have been about, were the orders that the troops are giving to go to Iraq, are them illegal orders?
Yes, I agree with you. Monica, thank you very much for a point well made.
Thank you, Tom.
Good to hear from you. Bye-bye. And on that point, by the way, just yesterday, day before yesterday, Wednesday, I guess it was, when Bush went to Iraq, the vice president of Iraq, Tariq al-Hashimi, personally asked George W. Bush for a date. Right? Personally said, set up a timetable. Here's a quote from the news story. Iraq's vice president has asked President Bush for a timeline for the withdrawal of foreign forces from Iraq, the Iraqi president's office said. Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi, a Sunni, made the request during his meeting with Bush on Tuesday when the U.S. president made a surprise visit to Iraq. I supported him on this, President Jalal Talabani said. In other words, he supported his vice president in asking Bush for a timeline, a date certain. In a statement released Wednesday, al-Hashimi's representatives could not immediately be reached for comment. So Bush is asked by the vice president and the president of Iraq for a timeline for the withdrawal of American forces. And he comes back and he's interviewed by the press here and he says, and I quote, the willingness of some to say that we're in power will withdraw on a set timetable concerns people in Iraq, because they understand our coalition forces provide a sense of stability so they can address old wrongs and develop their strategy and plan to move forward. They need our help, and they recognize that, and so they're concerned about that. And as Bush comes back and lies about it. He comes back and lies about it. It's incredible. Tom in Atlanta. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Tom, I think that the whole war in Iraq, the whole issue misses the broader point that we're in the midst of a class warfare in the country, and Iraq, I think, in the beginning was just a little diversion, a way of winning support. It looked like an easy win, looked like a way of currying support for the right-wing cause. And if we don't start focusing on the issue of what's happening to the middle class and the poor in this country and in terms of the corporatists and the rich, we're going to be in very, very serious trouble.
We already are, Tom.
Yeah, at every move, Tom, we're getting deeper and deeper into this mess.
Yep. I agree with you. It's a point well made, and it's, you know, we talk about economics on this program real regularly because when you get underneath it all, you dig down a little bit, you discover that the beginning and end pretty much of the right-wing agenda is economic. It's the reason why they want to stifle dissent, because they don't want people to speak up about economics. It's the reason why they want to have their war, so that they can win elections and look tough, and in part so that they can hand off more money to their buddies. I mean, look at these no-bid contracts with Halliburton. At the end of the day, it's all about who owns America, and because who owns America is who controls America, and that's the agenda that they're following. Tom, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Tom.
Good one. Dave in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to express to you that I'm pretty depressed after listening to the Iraq debate yesterday on C-SPAN. I was able to listen to it for 5 hours, and I know that may seem a little extreme, but I just got entranced with it, and I couldn't stop listening to it. And point after point was made by the Democrats in support of the John Murtha plan, and how what they wanted to do was redeploy the troops. And time after time, the Republicans stood up and went right by the playbook and right by the talking points and said that, you know, the Democrats want to completely withdraw all the troops and they want to cut and run. And they were using that they just kept using that. And then here's the thing.
And then Ann Coulter yesterday called for the murder of John Murtha. Believe it or not, she said the reason soldiers invented fragging. She said John Murtha is the reason soldiers invented fragging. Fragging is where a soldier, you know, throws a fragmentation grenade into another soldier's tent at night to kill him. You know, it's
unbelievable.
Yeah.
And Tom, here's the thing that just set me over the edge. Then last night, after I listened to C-SPAN for the majority of the day, I just right before bed went into see what was going on CNN, turned on the TV, and there they are regurgitating the same points the Republicans were putting forward, that John Murtha's plan is to withdraw all the troops and cut and run. And so here we have Fox News Network, which is number one in the country in TV ratings. Then you have
actually number one in cable TV ratings. They have a tiny fragment of the viewers that ABC, CBS, and NBC have.
That makes it feel a little bit better. But
yeah.
Still, CNN, but they're not providing any help to the left by just, like I said, simply regurgitating these Republican talking points when it's not the truth. And I lost count of how many Democrats were standing up and saying, look, the John Murtha plan is to pull back the troops to just right outside the border of Iraq, just station them there to see what happens, what Iraq can do on their own.
Right.
And if they can't, then we can do something about that.
This is the reason, Dave, that we need to start referring to this. Democrats need to start referring to this as the occupation of Iraq rather than the war. It's
right.
because any kind of movement within a war is perceived as either winning or losing. And with an occupation, you redeploy your forces. We're still in Germany. Are we occupying Germany? No. We ended the occupation of Germany within a year after the end of World War II, but we're still there. I mean, it is possible to still have forces helping out a friendly government. You can do that, but you have to end the occupation. But that was long after the war was over. We needed to make these differentiations. Dave, thanks for the call, and good on you for watching C-SPAN for 5 hours. What they're all doing, you know, 100% of the members of the House of Representatives are up for re-election this year. And what they're all doing is they're all basically posturing to get their commercials together and get ready for the this is all electioneering. Tamara or Tamara in Joplin, Missouri. Hey, Tamara.
Well, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. We have only about a half a minute here, Tamara, before we have to take a break.
Room.
I'm sorry.
Thanks for the tunes, Louise. I wanted to say I watched the whole thing yesterday as well, and it is beyond me why the Democrats even bother to vote on something like this, why they don't just walk out.
I agree.
And give the vote no credence.
It's hard to say.
Because it's a non-binding do-nothing resolution.
Yeah. On the other hand, I think the Democrats wanted to make their points. They wanted to get them on the record, and many of them did, and they did it very eloquently.
Well, yes, they should do the debate. But when it comes to the vote, they should walk out.
Yeah. Well,
but they didn't.
Yeah. It's
and
a tough
42
one.
42 voted yes for it.
There you go.
But three Republicans voted no, so kudos to the three Republicans knowing that it was a political ploy.
There you go. Tamara, thank you very much. Good to hear from you. In the next hour, Cal Dooley will be joining us in a heated discussion of the state's right to control their own food supply, but we'll be right back with your phone calls after this. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What would Jefferson do? What would Jefferson say if he saw his democracy fading away and corporate power and greed ruling the day? Well, it's too high a price for America to pay. Our Constitution tells us we must disobey, or this government of the people will be swept away. Bringing democracy back to the USA, 'cause it's slipping further and further away. And remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ears.
There you go. And welcome back. You can find that song on the web, as we did, over at Rob, I believe it's pronounced Moitoza, it's robmoitoza.com, robmoitoza.com. Tag your it, inspired by the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. David Poole and I, our producer here in our studio in Portland, Oregon, and in New York, Dan Jacobs and Alex Goldmark, the world's perkiest board op, putting the program together for us in New York City. 51 minutes past the hour, 9 minutes before the top of the hour. And let's see here, Billy in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Billy, what's on your mind today?
Tom, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a progressive station, right?
It is.
Now, help me with my words. Progress means to go forward, does it not?
Well,
progress. If we're making progress.
One could say, yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. Then my question is, as I have listened to you, not only today, but to some of the other shows, a great deal of what I hear is what George Bush is doing, the Republicans are doing, Rumsfeld is doing, what they have done. We're going back to Halliburton. A lot of, almost all of that is in the past. I even heard Al Franken play Rush Limbaugh once.
Yeah,
my question is, if this is a progressive station for us, quote, liberals, how does any of this help us at the grassroots level to make progress in winning back the House or the Senate, the Congress? Because what we're doing is rehashing over and over and over, as the gentleman was saying.
Billy, these are the issues. These are the issues. If you've got somebody who has committed a crime, somebody comes into your house and steals all your furniture, you're going to sit around and say, well, I guess I just need to move along here. I need to look forward. No, what I'm looking forward to is seeing some of these guys prosecuted for the crimes that they've committed.
Well,
we have war criminals running this government right now.
Okay, well, my take on that is, somebody came in and broke in my house, what I need to do is shore up my house so they don't break in again.
Well, obviously, we need to be doing that as well, and you will hear on this program a lot of discussion about a whole variety of things, from changing our trade policy to a functional trade policy, to changing, you know, raising the minimum wage, cleaning up our environment, stopping pollution and whatnot. So, but you have to know the problems in order to fix them, Billy. You have to know the problems.
Those of us out here can't do that. All of that can only be done in Congress, and you know that, Tom. All those rules are...
And those things, Billy, those things are not going to be done in Congress unless you and I start speaking out. And people are not going to be speaking out unless we talk about them. You can't just sit around, Billy, and say, we got a pain here. Might be cancer, might not. I think we'll ignore it. No, I'm sorry. We can't. You have to look at the problems head on. Ed in Orange County, California. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Your wife finds those songs, right?
Yeah, Louise. Yeah, she does a great job.
Tell her she's the reason a lot of us listen to the station.
Yeah, I'm sure you just put a smile on her face.
She does a great job. Not that you don't, but, man, she's great. Okay, I called up to let you know. On CNN this Saturday and Sunday is a whole program, a half-hour program, on the Blackwater people.
Oh, man.
And how they're just commending themselves because they went from an 8,000-square-foot building to a 68,000-foot-square building. They're telling how they were the first ones into New Orleans. And I think you need, I'm not sure what it's going to be, but it is patting them on the back because they're a great growing company.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
I'll be sure to check that out. Thanks for the heads
up. About ready to throw up.
Yeah.
And you know something? I've noticed something since 2000. Every morning when I get up and every night before I go to bed, I hear this sobbing. And I finally figured it out. It's Mother Nature and Lady Liberty crying.
Yeah, well
said. I think we need to start listening.
Yep. Ed, thank you very much for the call.
Bye.
I appreciate it. Phyllis in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Phyllis, what's up?
Hi, I'm just wondering why nobody's arresting Coulter. I mean, she could say all these horrible things, and she basically is inciting the murder of a government official.
Yeah, specifically Jack Murtha. I think that she has parsed her words. I mean, she's an attorney, right? And she used to be a law clerk, as I recall. Maybe I'm mixing her up with Laura Ingraham. One of them used to be a law clerk for Clarence Thomas. When she says Murtha is the reason soldiers invented fragging, that's not quite the same as saying that somebody should go out and kill Jack Murtha. That's just saying that it would be acceptable to her if it happened.
Isn't that cute?
Yeah, I suspect that she's within the boundaries of what's legal. It's whether it's what's moral or appropriate. I mean, you know, the rest of America, I think, is gagging at this. But
so we can say that about any Republican, and nothing will happen to us.
No, I'm telling you, if you were to say that about George W. Bush, you'd have the Secret Service knocking on your door.
Sure.
Yeah.
I don't think this is right that this woman can say these obnoxious, terrible things. I know we have freedom of speech.
Yeah, well, I think it's right that she can say them, and I think she also, A, she should be held accountable for it, and B, frankly, I am just astounded at the amount of airtime that NBC in particular, but some of the other networks as well, have given her and putting her on the air and letting her spew her hateful rhetoric. It's just, frankly, mind-boggling to me.
But this is not, it's not only from her, because I remember hearing Rush Limbaugh say that somebody should kill, who is it? Chelsea Clinton.
Yeah. I don't have a specific recollection of that, but yes, you're right. Hate talk on the right is an old, old game, Phyllis. It's been around for pretty much forever. So, coming up next on the program, we're going to hear from say it again, David.
Cal Dooley.
Cal Dooley. He's going to be here, and he's going to tell us, he's with the Restaurant Manufacturers Association, or the Restaurant Tours Association. He's going to tell us why, we really don't need to have state laws to protect our food supply. No siree. Yeah, this should be an interesting conversation. Stick around. We'll be right back. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. Cal Dooley is with us. He's the president of the Grocery Manufacturers Association and a former state representative from the state of California. The website for the Grocery Manufacturers Association, GMABrands.com. I'm looking at it right now. It says GMA represents the world's leading branded food, beverage, and consumer products companies. GMA member companies employ more than 2.5 million workers in all 50 states and account for more than $680 billion in annual sales. Cal Dooley, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom, but I should point out that I'm actually the president of the Food Products Association, and we will be merging with GMA at the end of this year, but right now it's a little premature to refer to me as president of GMA.
I see. Okay, so give me a different URL so I can...
Sure, we're at www.fpa-food.org.
Okay, great. Thank you, Cal.
No problem.
Cal Dooley, why... you guys are pushing the National Uniformity for Food Act.
Right.
Why do you want big government conservatives to take away the power of the states to control their food supplies?
Well, it's not an issue of controlling the food supply. It's how we're going to be providing consistent information to consumers. You know, over the years, we have made a decision that's in the interest of consumers to have, you know, labels on food be consistent across state lines. So when a consumer goes in and buys a box of Cheerios in California or New York or Texas, they can look at the nutrition facts panel and they'll see the same information that tells them the calories, the trans fat, the cholesterol content, the protein that is identical. They'll also find an identical set of ingredients as well as information that would be consistent across the state that deals with allergens that might pose a health risk to consumers. So what we're suggesting that when it comes to a warning label is that we ought to, again, have that national approach where we allow the Food and Drug Administration to really, you know, investigate the science that could be contributed by the states to make a decision on what is the appropriate information to provide to consumers.
But Cal Dooley, if you're really concerned about the consumers in this case, then why are you proposing legislation that establishes essentially a ceiling on information that can be provided rather than a floor? Why not just flip this thing around and say, okay, these are the minimum standards. These are the, you know, absolutely at a minimum, you have to reveal how much trans fat is in a product, or you have to reveal acrylamides, you know, the levels in the product, so you have to reveal that this product may cause birth defects, those kinds of things. As a minimum. Instead, you're taking the position that whatever we happen to decide, you know, whatever the federal government decides, you know, in collaboration with the Grocery Manufacturers Association, other organizations like this, and the lobbyists therefrom, whatever the federal government decides, that's the ceiling. And California can't have tighter standards. Florida, for example, right now, oysters, the standards for E. coli, the fecal bacteria, poop bacteria in oysters, is 1,000 times tighter in the state of Florida than the standards that you guys would have under this law.
The example in Florida is absolutely incorrect in that regulation would not be impacted at all by this legislation, in fact, because it deals with food sanitation. This legislation deals strictly with those issues that deal with warnings, labels in terms of the content of that product. And so it would deal with something like acrylamide. And we're not setting what you would say as a minimum standard here. Is what we're suggesting is...
No, you're setting a maximum standard.
What we're suggesting is that if the state of California thinks that they have evidence that is compelling and is science-based that would provide information that's important to consumers, is that they ought to present that evidence to the FDA. The Food and Drug Administration then would ask for comments from people in other states and other scientists from, you know, whatever constituencies, the consumer groups as well as the industry, and then they would make a determination on whether or not on balance, when they consider the benefits as well as the risk of consumption of a product, that should become then the national standard. So, in fact, it allows California, if they think they have the evidence, to present that information. And that, if that information is sound, it would then result in that California standard becoming the national standard.
So it allows California to compete with a $680 billion a year industry and its lobbyists for the voice of the federal Congress. I mean, right now you've got more than 200 laws in California that are going to be struck down that have to do with food labeling in that state that will be struck down if your National Food Uniformity or National Uniformity for Food Act is passed. Why are you guys so opposed to individual states being able to have any kind of power?
Tom, that figure of 200 is absolutely incorrect. We did a thorough analysis of that. That was put out by, you know, a group opposing it. You know, we have a lot of respect for a lot of...
It was put out by Senator Feinstein's office.
Yeah, and she was relying on information that was provided to her by a group that was opposing it. And our analysis, which we provided that information to Senator Feinstein, you know, clearly shows that it would impact at most... I think it's 13 laws nationally that are currently in effect. Nothing close to the...
We're not talking about national laws. We're talking about state laws.
No, that's what I'm saying, that it would only nationally, of those state laws, it would only impact 13. It doesn't even come close to the 200.
Why even one?
Pardon?
Why even one? I mean, why violate the principle of federalism on which this country was founded, that basically is enshrined in the 9th and 10th Amendments of the Constitutions, that power flows from the states up, not from the federal government down? Why do you guys, is it so that you can have one-stop shopping for lobbying?
No, what the issue is that when you deal with issues that have an application to interstate commerce clauses of the Constitution, is that we do take an approach which is national. You know, you can look at the precedents. We have one national approach when people or consumers are purchasing drugs, whether they be prescription or over-the-counter, is that we have warning labels that are applied for those or that are available for those drugs at the point of purchase that are on the containers that are national. We don't allow states to promulgate a separate standard, one over-the-counter or for prescription drugs.
But drugs don't vary from state to state. If you've got a group of folks in Vermont...
Don't vary from state
certainly
to state.
They do. If you've got a group of folks in Vermont who decide that they want to say, hey, you know, the apple's grown here, we don't use the same... we don't use atrazine like they do out in Washington State or whatever, you know, we're using different pesticides, or we're not using any at all, you know, this is organic stuff or whatever, and they want to specify, if they get together as a state and they say, we want to specify that this is how things have to be labeled, this is how you have to label these particular products in our state, why do you want to remove the power of individual states to decide their own food labeling standards?
If the state of California wants to label their products as California grown, this law has no impact on
them. I'm not talking about California grown. I'm talking about mandating that that food sold in those states be labeled in ways that reveals particular things. For example, the presence of for example, L-cysteine, you know, or aspartame. Things like that, glutamic acid compounds. Why take away from the states the ability to tell their consumers what's in their food?
Because we think it's important that that information be common throughout the country, that it be based on the best science, is that we allow, you know, the Food and Drug Administration to analyze that science. That science can be presented.
But Kel, that's not what you're doing.
Pardon?
It's not what you're doing. I'm asking you, why are you trying to establish a ceiling? And you come back and you answer to me that you're trying to establish a floor, but we both know that that's not true.
Is that what it allows for is if a state has a science that they can demonstrate that can make the case. That
then
the
they can't act on it in that state. You're forbidding the state from acting on the science in their own state with this law.
They can make the case that the floor is not high enough by the science that they have developed, is that they present it to FDA, and then it is considered through a formal process, and then, in fact, that more stringent standard would then become a national standard.
I just don't get it. Why big government conservatives are so worried about the state? Is it that, number one, it might be less profitable for your members if they have to label differently in different states, or is it, number two, that it's easier to buy off members of Congress at the federal level than it is to buy off members of Congress 50, you know, state by state over 50 states?
Well, there's absolutely no question that there is going to be some economies and some savings to manufacturers of food products if you have one label and one warning that is provided in every market in the country. What we currently have now, if we don't have the passage of this legislation, is that we, in effect, have not a federal preemption, but we have California preemption.
Right, and the consumers in California are going to have to pay more because you're going to pass along the expense of the added labeling. And so if they're going to legislate that they want to know the information but they're willing to pay for it, what's wrong with that?
The issue is that you will not have California. California will, in fact, set that one standard. You know, with California being the fifth largest economy in the country, or in the nation, or the world, excuse me.
It'll become the default standard. I get it. Cal, I'm sorry, we're out of time. You made your point, you made it very well. Cal Dooley, the website, fpa-food.org. Cal, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Next, Ford creating 150,000 jobs. Question is, where? 16 minutes after the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In the daytime, I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junk. Good Lord, have pity on me. At lunchtime, you can always find me at the Whole Earth Vitamin Bar. I'm just sucking on my plain white yogurt from my hand-thrown pottery jar. And sipping little hand-pressed cider with a carrot stick for dessert. And wiping my face in a natural way on the sleeve of my peasant shirt. Yes, I do. But when that clock strikes midnight and I'm all by myself,
I work that combination on my secret hideaway shelf. And I pull out some Fritos corn chips, Dr. Pepper, and an old moon pie. I sit back in glorious expectation of a genuine junk food high.
There you go. Welcome back. Oh, man, this is a toxic piece of legislation, National Uniformity for Food Act, House Resolution H.R. 4167. And you just heard both sides of the argument, and you can make up your own mind on it. And don't forget that you can call Congress, call your this is before the House of Representatives right now. You can call your member of Congress toll-free at 888-355-3588, 888-355-3588. And let them know what you think about the National Uniformity for Food Act, whether you think that Cal made a good point or whether you think I did, whatever it may be. Welcome back, by the way. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Give them a call, say hi. All things iPod, all things Macintosh, all things computer, really, ultimately. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE. The various telephone numbers. And by the way, as we're tossing out telephone numbers here, we have a comment line. If you have comments you'd like to share with us and you're just a little bashful to go on the air, but you like to rant, it may make it onto the air. Pick up the phone and give us a call at 503-323-6620. Give us your take in 30 seconds or less, because we'd like to hear from you, 503-323-6620. Remember, your thoughts and opinions may just make it out of the air, so make it count, 503-323-6620. Ford, in a blow to the UAW, this from the Wall Street Journal today, casts an eye to Mexico. Yes, Ford is going to invest $9.2 billion in building a new automobile factory and creating 150,000 jobs in Mexico. At the same time, it's shutting down factories in the United States. This based on a document that was apparently leaked out somehow. Ford planning comes as the UAW has elected President Ron Gettelfinger to a second four-year term at the annual meeting in what was supposed to be a show of strength before it squares off with the big three. This is going to make it really tough for the UAW to be negotiating with Ford when Ford says, okay, we'll ignore you because we're going to Mexico. The document, quoting the Jeffrey McCracken's article in the Wall Street Journal, the document appears to go well beyond the idea of this plan to show the greatest possible investment Ford and its suppliers could make in Mexico. Ford already has a Mexican assembly plant in Hermosillo. The Oakland Press's article appeared Wednesday, the day Ford President of America's Mark Fields gave a speech in Washington touting Ford's Made in America products. Well, I think he's talking about the North American continent. Must be, right? I mean, the President of Ford wouldn't just BS us. He wouldn't lie to us. As part of the Way Forward restructuring plan announced in January, the automaker said it plans to close at least 10 factories and eliminate 25,000 hourly jobs over the next 4 years here in the United States. But they're going to create 150,000 jobs in Mexico. Sure enough, I'm telling you, it's all about money. It is all about money when you get right down to the end of it. Larry in South Bend, Indiana. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I had a story that kind of proves your point from the end of the last hour there about how Ann Coulter can get away with all kinds of the hate speech and whatever, and those of us on the left can't.
Okay.
I was listening to another radio program the other day, and the host put out the question: was it worth your taxpayer dollars to send George Bush over to Iraq for 6 hours like that? And so I called the screener there. And he asked, well, what was your comment? I said, well, I have kind of a snarky joke. Maybe if there just happened to be like a roadside bomb over there or something, then maybe it would have been worth my taxpayer dollars. And then he says to me, oh, I don't think we can put that on. We might have some issues here. It's just like you said that, the Secret Service will come out if anybody on the left tries that, yet, Ann Coulter can get away with it so easily on the right.
Well, the reality, Larry, is that there is a specific law against threatening the President of the United States. And had you said that in a way that could be construed as anything other than, I mean, right, in this case, you're telling the story about telling the story, or, you know, it's a snarky joke or something like that. Had it been said in any way that could have been construed seriously, then, yeah, you could be in big trouble for it, you personally. And the Secret Service could come in, and they could go to the phone company of the radio station and say, we want to see all the records of the incoming calls, and the FBI could do that, rather. And, bang, you might have a guy knocking on your door.
Right. Well, it's like you said earlier about parsing words there. I mean, that Dan Coulter did that. I mean, it was the same kind of thing, though, wasn't it?
It is, sort of. I mean, well, yeah. Yeah, I think it is. And frankly, she won't be held to account for it. I agree with you that there are different standards, apparently, on the left and on the right. But also, there's a difference between the president and pretty much everybody else, for what it's worth. But good point, Larry. Thanks for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I see people turn their heads and quickly look away. Like a newborn baby, it just happens every day.
I look inside myself and see my heart is glad. I see my red door, I must have it painted black.
Maybe then I'll fade away.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. We need to bring in some light to the world. I mean, there actually is so much possibility. I've got to tell you, freedom, liberty, democracy is burned into the DNA of Americans. We have been operating under a democratic system of government. Yes, we've had our screw-ups, and it's been a rocky road. But by and large, we have been operating under a democratic form of government for over 200 years in this country, over 230 years in this country. It is part of us. And yes, you've got a bunch of proto-fascists in the White House right now who are, you know, hell-bent for leather on taking down individual liberties and shutting people up and looking into our bedrooms. And now the Supreme Court yesterday says, oh, they don't even have to announce themselves. Cops don't even have to announce themselves before they kick in your door. Which I'm thinking the police agencies of the United States should be up in arms about, because you're going to have a lot of folks who sleep with a gun beside their bed, and if they don't realize it's the police kicking in the door, they're going to start shooting. And this Supreme Court decision, in my opinion, is going to lead to more to dead cops and dead civilians, and not a good thing. And it's going to facilitate, you know, the occasional bad cop and the occasional bad police department, most of them usually in the rural South, but, you know, we all know that it happens from time to time, place to place. The vast majority of police officers in the United States are not just honorable people. They're doing a damn difficult job for relatively low pay. A lot of them can't even afford to live in the communities that they're policing. They, you know, good union job, but, you know, it's a tough one. It's a very tough one, putting their lives on the lines to keep the world safe for us. And I just have to believe, unless I'm missing something here, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, I'm on my morning program this morning, we heard from two police officers saying essentially the same thing. You know, this is not a good decision. But Roberts and Alito and Scalia and Thomas, they all think, oh, this is law and order. And it looks like increasingly they've got Kennedy voting with them. So, in any case, I forgive the rant, but the point is, yes, we see the country going off in these directions, but I still have hope. I still have hope. We have gone off on right-wing tangents before. The Supreme Court did, from 1905 to 1937, the Lochner Court, starting with the Lochner decision in 1905. We got our senses back. We woke back up. At the federal level, the presidential level, you know, we fell asleep. Harding and Hoover, and Coolidge and Hoover. And then we woke up. The Republican Great Depression, it woke us up. And Franklin Roosevelt came into office and brought us back to democracy in the United States. And we need another Franklin Roosevelt, frankly. And I personally believe there's a few of them out there. So We have a lot of work to do. We need to get active. We need to get organized. But despair is not the name of the game. Despair is not even an option. They want us to be in despair. Instead, we need to be getting active. Bonnie in Sacramento, California, listening on KSAC, Talk City in Sacramento. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Just love your show.
Thank you.
Wanted to talk about framing. I was ready to slam Senator Reid when you talked to him a couple of days ago at the convention. But
I don't, you know, I think he was so busy thinking about how he was going to frame his answer that he wasn't carefully listening.
Well, but as you mentioned, it had me thinking, you know, war versus occupation, and I think we need to go to our progressive candidates and get them starting to use those words since the current ones don't.
Yeah, I'm about halfway through writing an op-ed piece about this that I'll be posting this weekend in all probability on whatever website will take it. I'll start with Common Dreams.
Well, watching C-SPAN last night, I caught one Democratic representative, and I wish I remembered which one, said, "We can't cut and run from supporting our veterans when they get home."
Ha ha! Jujitsu! That's using their own energy against them.
And it was wonderful,
yeah.
Which reminded me of cutting and running from our Katrina.
There you go. Yep,
AFL-CIO is now putting pension money in to support funding rebuilding New Orleans.
Right, yeah, they're building low-income housing, affordable housing down there.
So
yeah.
That, you know, if we can get our folks to start talking about cutting and running from supporting our veterans, from supporting our children, from supporting our elderly.
From supporting the right of states to label their foods, basically from
right.
Supporting the middle class. The Republicans want to cut and run from the middle class. You're absolutely right. Bonnie.
And as long as it's within the first five words of the sentence, it'll get on the air.
There you go. Brilliant, Bonnie. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Cindy in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Cindy.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. You were at the Take Back America conference last week, right?
I was there Monday and Tuesday. Yeah.
Okay.
And Wednesday, I was on an airplane all day.
Uh-huh. So do you know what Representative Jan Schakowsky talked about while she was there? She gave a speech the last day of the conference.
The last day of the conference was when I was flying home, so no, I missed it. I'm sorry.
This is fantastic. She gave a speech which absolutely had the crowd roused about winning in 2006, and the first thing she noted is this. We must not allow the Republicans to steal the election again. After reading Bobby Kennedy's article in Rolling Stone, she concludes, it must have been stolen. And she apologizes to the people who contacted her after that election, worried about the integrity, and she didn't believe them.
Yeah.
And so she says, Tom, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is going to come out with a plan soon to address this issue. And she didn't say anything more than a plan soon.
Yeah.
But I am so psyched about this.
That is great. Well, Jan Schakowsky is wonderful. She's been on our program at least once or twice in the last couple of years. She's a hellraiser. She's good. She's really good.
I'm absolutely missed, and I'm so glad that RFK is getting the support. And not only does she talk about the issue of election theft, she says we've got to get the citizens' effort to make sure that the machines, the ballots, the registration process, we need thousands and thousands of Democratic Party supporters on the ground participating in the elections. And she is upbeat about this.
Yeah.
We've got to get out the vote. We've got to persuade the persuadables. And we've got to work on this at all levels. And this is so much what I've been hoping that the Democratic Party would reach.
Spot on. So, Cindy, the work that you have to do, the work that I have to do, the work that all of us have to do now is to get in touch with our individual representatives and say, follow Jan Schakowsky's lead. Get out there. Do what she's doing. Say what she's saying. We need to be following her lead. Absolutely. Cindy, thanks so much for the call. Great to hear from you. Kirk in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Kirk.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call and agree with you 100% on what you had to say about the Supreme Court decision. I'm a retired police officer, did it for 20 years, and now I've gone back to school to work on becoming a school teacher, but I just cannot believe that the Supreme Court would allow officers to come crashing into doors without an announcement.
Yeah, now for our listeners who are not familiar with this, Kirk, we should set this up. It is possible for police officers to get a no-knock warrant. If they can demonstrate to a judge that there's a probability that when they walk in the door, there's going to be a guy with a machine gun nest there, you know, a bunch of drug dealers or terrorists or something like that, then, you know, a court can and very often does issue no-knock warrants. And that's something that we all support and is perfectly legitimate. But my concern is there are so many handguns in this country, and there are so many people around this country who are so, you know, unnecessarily in many cases, absolutely paranoid. They've been watching too much TV that, you know, if somebody yells, it's the police, and they're banging on the door, they're not going to pick up their gun and go to the door. Or if they do, they're going to have it down at their side, not out in front of them. But if they just hear the door splintering, you know, they're going to start shooting.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to be, when I was young, I used to be on the SWAT team, and that's what we did. We got no-knock warrants when we had, you know, reason to believe that, you know, something really dangerous was behind that door, and we needed to be able to just surprise them as best we could.
Sure.
The only other thing I'd say is I'm not sure it's going to make that huge a difference, because so many judges, you know, they're going to interpret what their state law is and how they issue warrants.
Yeah.
And all a defense attorney is going to have to do they will try to have the courts interpret the exclusionary rule through their own state constitution instead of the federal constitution.
Well,
and a state can be more restrictive. They just can't be more lax.
Well, that's interesting. That's very interesting. Kirk, thank you very much. My take on that was also that it may be that most police officers, most police departments will simply continue to announce themselves just because they don't want some yahoo shooting at them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you.
If you're going out to serve a search warrant on somebody who's a pothead or somebody who, you know, was involved in passing bad checks, you don't want to go kicking in their door and have a chance, you know, in all probability, they're not going to be shooting at you.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Kirk, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good.
Bye-bye.
Good to know my instincts were at least reasonably valid. Sean in Indianapolis. Hey, Sean, we've got just a little less than a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, we've gotten 4 phone calls from people in Indiana this hour.
I know. It's Indiana Day.
Yeah. All 4 professors in Indiana, all 4 of us called.
Okay, great.
Hey, I just want to let you know that don't worry about the right wingers using the internet to forward their.
That's it. Sean, I'm going to put you on hold, and you can finish that thought when we come back from the break. I haven't heard from you in quite a while. It's great to hear from you again, and we'll come back to you. And all of our other callers, too. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Remember the
tag your ears.
Indeed, my friends, welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick plug, and thanks to Blue in Missouri for reminding me of it, Operation Helmet. The website is operation-helmet.org, and they have sent 8,300 upgrades so far to soldiers in Iraq of their helmets so that if they get hit in the head, they don't have closed head injuries. And this is important stuff. If you want to help out the soldiers, this is a real organization doing good work. Operation-helmet.org. Back to Sean in Indianapolis. Hey, Sean.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I was going to say, don't worry about the right wingers using the internet to further their political objectives, because if you don't let them have at least part of it, then they're going to think of lots and lots of evil ways to restrict it.
For example,
so, you know, you got to let the babies have their candy. We have already are so established on the internet that you know, we outnumber them exponentially.
Well, actually, the Drudge Report, the right wing Drudge Report, is probably the most active news site, or one of the most active news sites out there. But Sean, the thing that concerns me is this whole net neutrality thing, where basically they want to say, if you you know, the big phone companies, Verizon, AT&T, if you can afford to pay them millions of dollars a year for speed, then your web pages will load really fast. Everybody else's web page is going to load slow. And that's just wrong. We're going to be debating that on Monday, in fact.
But see, that's more of an economic thing as opposed to a political ideology.
Yeah.
I wasn't talking about net neutrality. I was talking about conservative activists.
Yeah. No, okay. I got you. Got you and agree with it.
All right.
Sean, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you.
Bye.
Bill in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Listen, I'll preface my comments with I'm a retired over 30-year Chicago police detective.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, you've made your audience aware of the fact that there were no knock warrants issued before.
Yeah.
My problem, as soon as I heard about this, were two things. First,
the Supreme Court decision.
Obviously, yeah, right, the Supreme Court decision. Obviously, as you referred to the amount of guns we have in our homes in the United States, the first thing was, if I was a prosecutor, I'd be upset about this, because most jurisdictions have extra penalties if you assault or kill a police officer.
Right.
This has given those people an affirmative defense that, hey, it's common knowledge that the police just break in without announcing, and I thought it was somebody breaking in, and I started shooting.
Save
my family.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to throw a little more mud into the...
It'll make it harder to prosecute somebody who inappropriately or illegally or whatever the term is, shoots a police officer.
Right.
Oh, man.
I would think so.
Yeah.
I mean,
makes perfect sense.
Happy if I was a prosecutor, because you know as well as I do, the jury prospective jury pool is going to know about this, probably know about it because they tend to be the ones who read the newspapers. They tend to be the one who keep up on things.
Yeah,
you know?
I just don't get it. Why Scalia, Thomas, Alito?
Well,
why these guys think that this is law and order stuff? I mean,
well,
just.
They don't have any experience in this stuff, and they just, you know, they just, if it
Well,
if
why
it
does the Bush Justice
off,
Department think it is? I mean, this was the Bush administration who was arguing on behalf of eliminating the requirement to get a no-knock warrant if you're gonna do a no-knock, whatever you call it.
Well, let's face it, the Bush administration.
Cheney, but it ain't going to happen in the Republican Congress. We'll talk about that when we come back to 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is absolutely amazing. This more evidence that this is the most corrupt administration in the history of the United States. Here you have a sitting vice president sitting on millions and millions of dollars worth of stock and stock options in a company that he used to be the CEO of. He went from government, where he was helping this company get deals when he was in the Ford administration, where he was the Secretary of Defense, went from government to the head of Halliburton, where he started growing Halliburton, getting more government deals. And then he goes back into government as VP, and now, according to Judicial Watch, they have the goods, they have the proof that he's bringing these contracts in to Halliburton. I mean, this is from one of the contracts dated March, or from one of the internal emails dated March 5th, 2003, from the Army Corps of Engineers. We anticipate no issue with this. This is with the KBR deal, the Kellogg Brown and Root Halliburton deal. This is the sweetheart no-bid contracts deal. We anticipate no problem, no issue, since the action has been coordinated with the vice president's office. I mean, how much corruption do you need before you realize that we have gone over the top, that we have gone over the edge, that it is right, screaming, flaming over the edge. I mean, this is a Thelma and Louise moment. Or am I too hard on Thelma and Louise? This is incredible. And it's Judicial Watch. I mean, it's Larry Klayman's organization. It's the right-wing guy who helped bring down Bill Clinton's administration. The difference is that when Larry Klayman filed his lawsuit on behalf of Paula Jones, which led to, in the course of discovery, which led to the discovery of Monica and led to Bill Clinton lying about Monica, which led to Clinton's impeachment, there was an investigation because at least one House of Congress was controlled by Democrats. But right now, because the Republicans control the House of Representatives, and they control the Senate, and they control the Supreme Court, and as control of the Supreme Court, they put the president into office in 2000, even though the majority of Americans voted for Al Gore, both nationwide and in Florida. But with all three branches of government locked up by the Republicans, and then the fourth branch of government, the fourth estate, being ruled by Republican-friendly multinational corporations, the press, there's not only no investigation of Cheney's inside dealing. I mean, this would make Teapot Dome look small. There's not only no investigation of it, there's not even any discussion of it. This is just so wrong. This is just so wrong. We must, in the United States, if we are to have a country that is going to survive, in which democracy is going to survive as we go into the future, we must have a government that we can trust, a government that is accountable, that is transparent, that understands that it works for we the people, not the other way around. You know, the good news is that there's a bunch of people who get that. Some of them in the Republican Party, and a lot of them in the Democratic Party. But there's, you know, the sad news, the tragic news is there's a bunch of folks who don't get that. And they're just sitting around going, well, you know, to the winner go the spoils. No, well, whoever has the most money, you know, the golden rule, whoever has the gold rules, these kinds of cliches. No, it's wrong. And then you got Denny Hastert out here talking about this is incredible. This is absolutely incredible. Denny Hastert suggesting that we should follow disasters. It's like the equivalent of saying, you know, the captain of the Titanic went down with the ship. We should go down with the ship, too. Listen to this clip.
We in this Congress must show the same steely resolve as those men and women on United Flight 93. The same sense of duty as the first responders who headed up the stairs of the Twin Towers.
Yes, let's go charging off to our deaths. This is incredible. I mean, yes, of course, the people on Flight 93 were heroes, and the first responders in 9/11 were heroes, but I'm sorry, Denny Hastert, you are not a hero, and neither is George W. Bush. And how dare you draft Dodgers and AWOL? Well, Bush is more than AWOL. If you're gone more than 30 days, you're a deserter. How dare you draft Dodgers and deserters? Dick Cheney saying he had better things to do. Rush Limbaugh, he had a pimple on his butt, got him out. I mean, how dare these people say that our soldiers, our young men and women who actually did volunteer and who actually are there carrying weapons into battle, it's worse than battle. How dare they say, well, they should, you know, they should do it just like these other folks did who went to their death because of our incompetence. The Bush administration could have stopped 9/11. We know that now with a reasonably high level of certainty. They could have stopped 9/11. They had all the warnings. They knew this thing was coming. I am not yet convinced that they knew exactly where or exactly when, but they certainly knew within a few weeks, and they certainly knew broadly it was going to be New York and Washington, and they certainly knew it was going to be airplanes. And afterwards, you had being hijacked. Afterwards, you had Condoleezza Rice going, oh, nobody could have anticipated somebody would hijack an airplane. But just 3 months earlier, when Bush had been in Europe for a G7 meeting, he had slept overnight at an aircraft carrier because there were credible news reports that Al-Qaeda was going to hijack a commercial jetliner and fly it into the hotel where Bush was staying. And that was on the nightly news. And she comes out with these bold-faced lies, and then nobody calls her on it. Nobody in the news media. So Denny Hastert is saying, okay, you got some heroes here, and they're heroes because the Bush administration let them down. Condi Rice let them down. Dick Cheney let them down. Dick Cheney, his first job when he became vice president, he was given two responsibilities by George W. Bush. One was to lead up the Energy Task Force, which started meeting in secret to plan the sale of the Iraqi oil fields to oil companies all around the world in March and April of 2001, 6 months before 9/11. And the second job he was given, which was really the first job because it was, you know, when Al Gore handed off the job to him, he said, this is your most important job. The other job he was given was being the head of the counterterrorism task force. Look out for Osama bin Laden. Find out about these guys who are coming to take us out. And did he do it? No. The counterterrorism task force that Dick Cheney headed didn't even meet until September of 2001. Didn't even have a meeting. So the Bush administration, through their incompetence, or if the conspiracy theorists are right, in their hopes that they would have a Pearl Harbor type event, to paraphrase the Project for New American Century, what would be necessary to get the American people behind an invasion of Iraq? You can read it right there, newamericancentury.org. It's right there on their website, signed by Jeb Bush, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Doug Feith, Wolfowitz. You can read the whole thing. That because The folks on that airline became heroes because of the Bush administration failures, and because those firefighters in New York were heroes because of the Bush administration failures. We should continue following with more Bush administration failures.
We in this Congress must show the same steely resolve as those men and women on United Flight 93. The same sense of duty as the first responders who headed up the stairs of the Twin Towers.
It's breathtaking. Breathtaking. The arrogance that these guys have, that they actually believe that Americans are not going to remember that the greatest security failure in the history of the United States happened on the watch of George W. Bush, and he had over 50 warnings, and the 9/11 Commission laid it out. It is no secret. We know it. And yet there has not been one hearing on this, because the Republicans will not allow it to happen. Not one investigation. Not one serious, credible, bipartisan investigation. Not one! Next, Karl Rove in New Hampshire taking care of his corrupt GOP officials. And your calls. 1-866-440-8466. Right after this. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. For a change.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There's a war tonight, and the moon turns the tide. When the stars take their ride, she'll be leaving. Where she goes, I don't know. She won't tell me what it is that makes her act like this. Should I ask, do you like to go walking on the shore, listen to the sea? Could it be someone kind?
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Is that Tom Rush? I don't know. You know, Tom Rush is an old friend of mine. I haven't talked to him in years, but used to know him back in New Hampshire. And boy, could he do some marvelous music, and I can't quite tell. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This, Karl Rove, this is incredible. Last night, Karl Rove went to New Hampshire and spoke to 500 activists at the New Hampshire Republican State Committee's annual dinner. He says, listen to my speech. It'll be a good one for you. I'm here to tell you that this red Republican state here, this is a red state. Talking about New Hampshire. Outside, 100 demonstrators holding up signs that says, Karl Rove 666. You do know the Republican elephant has the upside-down stars on it. You know, the symbol of the devil. Where the two little points are at the top, like the horns. And the one point goes down to the bottom, like the little chin of the goat. As opposed to the stars the way they are on the flag, for example, where it's like Da Vinci's, you know, man, where you've got the head at the top and the arms sticking out and the legs down. A lot of folks picking up on that. It's pretty amazing. Anyhow, so the party raised $60,000 from this thing. And what's that money for? It's to pay the legal bill of a guy who got busted for phone jamming the Democratic Party. This is incredible. Former state GOP executive director Charles McGee has admitted engineering a plan to jam get-out-the-vote telephone lines at five state Democratic offices and the Manchester Professional Firefighters Association headquarters on the morning of Election Day 2002. And there are some who suggest that the only reason John Sununu is in the Senate instead of the Democratic Governor Gene Shaheen, who was very popular in the state of New Hampshire, is because of this Republican dirty trick. Because the Republicans, they're always all about reducing the vote. If you reduce the number of voters, then you reduce the number of Democratic voters, because the majority is Democratic. It's like, you know, Paul Weyrich laid this thing out back a decade ago.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And they sure did drive it down successfully in New Hampshire, and thus they got John Sununu into the Senate and Gene Shaheen left out in the cold. And this guy, he got nailed. He got prosecuted. He got convicted. He went to jail for about a year on this thing. And so Karl Rove goes to New Hampshire to raise money for his legal defense. Isn't that sweet? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Is it to Johanna or Jonna?
It's Jonna.
Jonna in Olympia, Washington. Hi.
That's correct. Mr. Hartman, first of all, thank you so much for what you're doing for our nation. I'm very deeply appreciative. Second, it saddens me deeply to have to speak to my neighbors across the country this way. But I must ask, are we really afraid of the C word? If there's been a theft of a presidential election that constitutes a coup,
you're right.
Every American patriot must put personal concerns aside, turn off the television, get off the beach, and go to work.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I do not disagree with you. Particularly in 2001, in November of 2001, when the New York Times published the story showing that no matter how the count was done, no matter what measure you used, Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush did in Florida, and therefore legitimately won the presidency of the United States, but that George W. Bush's daddy's appointees to the Supreme Court and some very good lawyers coached by John Roberts, the attorney John Roberts, arguing before the Supreme Court in the lawsuit initiated by George W. Bush, Bush v. Gore. I've even heard right-wing talk show hosts say that this was Gore's lawsuit, right? No, sorry, it was Bush's, through the election, or handed the presidency to him. Yes, you're right. I would not be reluctant to call that a coup. And I would say the same thing of the election in 2004 after I've read Bobby Kennedy's piece.
Yes, unfortunately, the operatives don't come slicker than this. They've had many years to practice behind the scenes. This is a process of not one major action, but many, many, many small, minor, cumulative actions.
Yeah, it's like being pecked to death by baby ducks.
Precisely, each one requiring a separate investigation, a separate court case. No one has the money or the time to do that. Meanwhile, what they're doing is stalling so that they can put, as you say, more judges in place so that it doesn't matter by the time the legal challenges come. It's too late. We've got to act now.
Jonna, I agree with you. And as a starting point, let's get more and more of our elected representatives reading Bobby Kennedy's piece in Rolling Stone and holding them to it. Every single one in the last couple of days that I've interviewed this morning, I had Senator Ron Wyden on my local program. One of my first questions was, have you read Bobby Kennedy's piece? 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Tom Hartman here, the place where despair is not an option, my friends. Get out there, get active. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joe in Brookings, Oregon on the line. Hey, Joe. Whoops, my internet connection froze and croaked as of 2:30. Oh, it just came back. Okay. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Yeah, first, before I get on my topic, you were talking about that pimple on Rush Limbaugh's butt that kept him out of the Vietnam War. That was no pimple. That was Sean Hannity.
Okay.
So I just want people to know that Sean Hannity saved Rush Limbaugh's life. So he's not such a bad guy after all.
Yeah.
No, but speaking of pimples on the
I'm not even going to go there.
speaking of pimples on the backside of humanity, of course, Ann Coulter was on the Tonight Show the other night,
But the reason I was really excited about that show, and I was telling everybody about it to go watch it and everything, I usually don't go around telling people to watch Jay Leno, was that George Carlin was on that show too.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see it. What happened?
That's just it. Nothing did happen. There was no debate between the two or nothing. I mean, George Carlin, he comes out, does his, you know, little comedy routine, does his little interview, and then Ann Coulter comes on right after him, and basically no fire between the two or nothing.
That's why they did it in that order. If Ann Coulter had come out first, Carlin would have come out and taken her apart. That's why they organized it in that direction.
Yeah, and another thing that's amazing to me about Ann Coulter is not the few conservatives like Michael Sewage of the Sewage Nation that call her the Paris Hilton of the right. It's all the conservatives that take up for her and they defend her like Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and
yeah,
Sean Hannity and the rest of these idiots.
It's tragic. It's really tragic. Yep. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. It's truly tragic. Berkeley in Sacramento, California. Hey, Berkeley, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. You know, the 06 elections are going to be about Iraq. And continuing the point that Democrats need to declare the conflict in Iraq is an occupation and not a war.
Yes.
You've got to keep hammering that home. It's a great point. Also, to help emphasize that point, the other message that we need to get out there is the troops are guarding the contractors.
Yes. To a large extent, and the contractors are not doing what the contractors are supposed to be doing.
No,
they're
not building the infrastructure the way we promised. Instead, they're building an embassy the size of Vatican City, and yet we claim that
we're doing it without any Iraqi employees. By the way,
absolutely,
the largest we're over 20 buildings on over 100 acres, the largest construction project in the country, probably one of the largest construction projects in the entire Middle East, $1 billion construction project, and it has not generated one single Iraqi job. We are importing labor from Bangladesh and Sri Lanka to work on this thing.
And this is the message we need to get out there. We need to keep saying that. I mean, it's not just an occupation, but the troops are guarding the contractors in the business that they are doing. It's not a war against terror. It's basically, you know, it's all part of the biggest heist in the history of the world. But I mean, we're not planning on leaving anytime soon. And that embassy and the message that the troops are guarding the contractors needs to be hammered home the same way the occupation does.
Yeah, good point. Thank you very much, Berkeley.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Good to hear from you, Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Oh, wow. Several of us on the chat have been discussing this net neutrality and wondering if you have a thought for us on it.
Oh, I do. In fact, we're going to be debating a guy from Ayn Rand on the topic on Monday. Basically, you've got the conservatives out there saying that government needs to get hands off the Internet. Don't regulate the Internet, which is right-wing speak for let's let the corporations rule this thing. I used to run forums for CompuServe back in the 80s, starting around 83, 84, something like that, even before there was an Internet, back when the Internet was CompuServe, and it, just as AOL was starting up. And did that through right up until, I don't know, about 8-10 years ago, something like that. And I remember a meeting that we had in Columbus, Ohio, which was the headquarters of CompuServe. At the time, it was owned by H&R Block, in which they brought in this guy. Barry Berkoff was the president of CompuServe at the time, and he brought in this guy who did this demonstration for us of what the Internet was. You know, here's this new language, HTML. We were all just blown away by HTML. Isn't that incredible? And then a couple of years later, after Barry had left and AOL took over CompuServe, I was in Columbus for another meeting, and there was a discussion about how they had figured out that the switches that they had, because most users on the Internet at that time were AOL or CompuServe users. This was the very early days of the Internet. That the switches that they had through the routers, that they were, you know, routing data through their system, had the ability to speed up or slow down individual connections. In other words, you could cause a web page from, say, Disney to load in a tenth of a second, whereas you could cause a web page from, say, the New York Times to take 3 seconds to load. And what was being kicked around was the idea of, hey, why don't we say to big companies, if you want your web page to load fast, you have to pay us. And if you don't pay us, then we're going to default all the routers to a 1 second delay. And if you pay us, then there'll be it'll only be a tenth of a second delay or something like that. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was that sort of a thing. And it got kicked around, and ultimately they decided not to do it. They decided that the blowback from the users would be so great that they would lose so many customers and anger so many people that they weren't going to do it. And I thought that was the end of the topic. I mean, this was like literally 15 years ago, Dave. And that's what net neutrality is all about right now, is the companies that own the big pipes, the huge pipes, the you know, the main line that connects New York City to Chicago kind of thing, you know, or the five lines basically that are capable of connecting New York to Chicago. They're all, virtually all of them are owned by companies like AT&T and Verizon and MCI and whatnot. And these companies are now saying, okay, we've got zillions of packets of data passing through, and we're able to tell which IP addresses this stuff originated from and which IP addresses it's going to. And what we'd like to do is be able to say everybody is going to run a little bit slower on the web, except those folks who pay us. And so if Disney and NBC and CNN and, you know, the big players, New York Times, whatnot, the people who we know have deep pockets and they want to get their websites out there, pay us $1 million a month or whatever it is, and we'll make sure that your website traffic goes through really fast. And right now, it's against the law for them to do that. And that's called government interference by the conservatives, making it against the law for them to do that. And right. This piece of legislation that would allow them to do that is being pushed by conservatives and Republicans, and basically it would eliminate net neutrality. Right now the law is that if you're handling internet data, regardless of the source of the data, you have to handle it the same way as all other data. And they want to be able to regulate the speed at which data flows depending on where it originates and where it's going. It's not so much that they're going to come to you and me, the consumer, and say, you guys have to pay an extra buck and a half a month if you want data to come to you faster. It's that they want to go to the originators of the data. And so folks like me, you know, I've got a website at TomHartmann.com. It's a relatively small website. I mean, I'm not only not making money on the thing, I lose money on it, but it's there. You know, it promotes my books. It promotes the show. You know, I'm willing to take the small hit on it. But if they came to me and they said, hey, you got to pay us $100,000 a year if you want your pages to load fast, I'd be out of business.
Yeah, well, many of us have noticed that the cons and the corporatists don't always act in our best interest, however they market it.
There you go. Dave, thanks for the call, and thanks for giving me an opportunity to go off on that rant. I appreciate it. Margie in Brookings, Oregon, on the line. Hey, Margie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Are you familiar with the Clark Howard show?
Yes, I am. In fact, when I lived in Atlanta, I knew Clark Howard.
Oh, well.
He and I both own travel agencies at the same time.
Oh, neat. Well, for those that don't know, his radio show is as a consumer advocate, would you
yes.
say?
Yeah.
And last night he was begging people to call about what this Ohio congressman is about to do. The congressman is a Republican, of course. His name is Steve LaTourette, and he is trying to nullify a law that's currently in action called the ID credit freeze law.
Right. Now, yes, and for our listeners who are not familiar with this, and I think I talked about this yesterday, but if I didn't, I do a couple of different radio programs, and if I talked about it on another program instead of this one, my bad, because this is a big deal. Right now, in a whole bunch of states, and I don't have the list right in front of me, but in about a third of the states in the United States, using state law, and in most of the rest of the United States, just basically using the policies of the credit companies, you can call up. Let's say that you're concerned. Let's say that you're a veteran, okay? Or there's a veteran in your family. All of the veterans' data got stolen recently, as you know. I mean, it's been in the news. And you know that in the next 6 months, you're not going to buy a house, you're not going to buy a car, and you're not going to apply for a new credit card. And so you're not going to need to use your credit report, in other words, your credit data. So you call up the credit card, you call up the credit company, and you say, freeze my data for 6 months. What that means is if somebody has stolen your identity and they try to open a line of credit or try to open a bank account or try to get some cash anywhere, whatever, when they check the credit report, they'll say there's a freeze on this. They won't be able to do it. This guy wants to make it illegal for you to do that. And the reason why is he's being supported by the credit card companies in this. The reason why is because all the credit card companies are now selling this as a service. They want you to have their credit protection service for $40 a year, $50 a year, $60 a year. And the credit reporting companies want to sell this as a service. And they see an opportunity to make money off the people's fear of identity theft. And so they want to make it illegal for us to, for free, be able to lock down our credit. Our credit history and our credit information, and have to pay for it. Did I do a good job of describing it, Margie?
I think so.
Yeah. So the LaTourette bill. The credit freeze bill. Just call your member of Congress and just absolutely raise hell with them. 1-888-355-3588 is the toll free number for Congress for all across the United States. Margie, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Good talking to you. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartmann Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tag your ribs.
Indeed, my friends. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here. You're in the middle of the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. None whatsoever. Ron in Miami, Florida on the line. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to speak with you today.
Well, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for being who you are and giving us the truth here. But what I see here is going on is that you were talking about how the elections have been stolen. I think that's the primary issue here. And issues like gay marriage and immigration, even the war itself, is just a bogus issue. It's a MacGuffin. Whatever you want to say about it, it's an issue so that the Republicans can say that people have come out to vote in elections when they're just stealing the elections.
Well, let's be real upfront here about this, Ron. The people are dying in this war. It's a very real thing.
I understand that.
You know, the middle class is being wiped out because of our trade policies and our immigration policies. These are very real things. However, I agree with you that what they're doing is they are using these things to rationalize the theft of elections. In other words, actually, the media is. I mean, the election gets stolen in Ohio, and all the talking heads are sitting around going, well, it must be because they had an anti-gay marriage thing on the ballot. No,
right,
it's because
exactly.
They stole the damn election.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. They're using this issue so as cover.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying they're not real issues and they need to be addressed at some time in the future, but they're using this issue as cover to say that more Republicans are voting or the more people are coming out, when in fact the truth is they're stealing the elections.
Yeah.
As that lady said earlier, we have had a coup d'etat in this country.
Yes, I agree with you. Ron, thank you for the call.
And I hope you'll address more time to that. We need to figure out how to clean up our election system.
Well, in my mind,
none of what's going on in this country right now, it has been the will of the American people. None of it.
I agree. And step one is we have to wake up our politicians to the fact that the elections are being stolen. And I think
you to do that.
I'm working my butt off on that one, Ron. I'll tell you. And I know that Bobby Kennedy is doing the same. And there's a bunch of us out here working on it. And you should be too. Call your elected representatives and talk to their members of staff and say, hey, no, we're not, you know, this has to end. 52 minutes past the hour. Joe in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to say the guest you had on earlier today about the, nationalization of food safety and protection and for consumers.
Yeah, the guy from the Food Manufacturers Association. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they've already pretty much done that because they have what they call federal preemptions. For public regulations, and basically for the right wing to say that they're anti-regulation and they think that the free market should be able to go ahead and take care of the citizens' needs through that system, they want to regulate the regulation agencies to make it so that states cannot have any protection for any of the consumer protections for, say, food, environment, health, pollution, emissions, any of those things. They put the bar so low to the ground, instead of the federal government being the floor, and any states could go ahead and make better regulations and things for their citizens in their own states, they've redefined it. They've made it the opposite. And they've got budgets through the Defense Department, appropriations going through right now for energy changes, for transmission lines. They want to make the infrastructure of our country so decrepit that they end up having to go ahead and not regulate it. And if the companies or the contractors voluntarily give the Department of Homeland Security to Chertoff, only one person, if they go ahead and voluntarily give him written problems or assessments where some of the faults are or anything like that, then it's just completely confidential. It's national security secret, and they cannot be liable for anything.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, I devoted a chapter to this in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, about how, for example, during the Reagan administration, Monsanto went to Vice President Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush Sr.,
right,
went to him and said, we need regulations on genetically modified organisms. Now, at that time, there weren't any. They had not yet finished inventing them. And they said, we need regulations on these things. Why? Because they wanted to legalize them. Regulations legalize things.
Right.
You know, the mining industry has asked for regulations. We want 10 parts per million in arsenic in the water. Why? Because that means that if they're poisoning somebody's downstream water to the tune of 7 parts per million, they can't be sued because it's below the federal standards. So, yes, you're absolutely right. Industry is constantly asking for regulation, and they're doing it either to protect monopolies or to legalize behavior that otherwise would subject them to lawsuits as a consequence of harm to citizens. Joe, I got to move along. Thank you. You make a very good point. You made it very eloquently. I appreciate it. Joe, and another Joe in Anchorage, Alaska. Hey, Joe.
This is a Joe and Ink, but not as good a voice as the other Joe.
There you go.
When I called in, you were talking about the five-pointed star.
Yes, sir.
And whether it's displayed right side up or upside down, I draw your attention to the swastika, which has shown up as a symbol many years before Germany usurped it.
Oh, yeah, it was used by the Buddhists, Buddhists, you know, thousands of years ago.
It's very simple. Yeah. I think the Eastern Star, if you look at it, the Masonic Star, the Medal of Honor, the highest award the United States gives out, are stars that are pointed in a way that emphasizes one point being rooted in the earth, two points going to the right and the left representing service on this earth, and two points reaching up in a very receptive
Well, it could be, Joe, and I've brought this up on the program before, and I get a lot of email from folks saying, you know, this is this or that, and I encourage you to Google around on it. My understanding of the five-pointed star being upside down on the Medal of Honor, and that's the only place in American, in official United States use of stars where it's upside down, was that back in the old days when they were making Medals of Honor, the easiest way to hang the thing from somebody's neck, because you hang it around their neck, or you hang it from something that, you know, was to drill little tiny holes in the tops of two of the star points so that you could attach it to two points so it wouldn't dangle, and that's how the Medal of Honor came to be an upside down star.
Mother of invention.
Yeah, there you go. I can't claim that, you know, firsthand knowledge of that. I wasn't around when they started out. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. And everybody else who's called in. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Monday, conservative Alex Epstein and I are on opposite sides of net neutrality. Tune in as I do battle on the side of freedom. And activist and actor Mike Farrell is going to be here about his blog. It's called How Dare They? That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.